Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Let me set the table before I introduce my guests. Political prisoners in America is one of my core topics. I write about it often, and I have radio programs about it often. And it's not something new. The targets vary through the years, but doing it is not something new. It goes back many, many decades. In past decades, we had two Red Scares, falsely accusing people of being communists. My goodness, for having leftist views or believing in social justice makes you a communist. Happened under Woodrow Wilson around 1918, or the early 1920s, I think, mainly. Happened in the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, at the House Un-American Activities Committee, at the Joe McCarthy era. My goodness, I saw that beast live on television when I was a boy in the 1950s. Well, it continues, and since the 9/11 event, the main target of choice has been Muslims. One other category as well, people who are environmental and animal rights activists, but today we'll talk about Muslim political prisoners. And last December 1st, on Global Research and many other websites, I wrote an article called Criminal Injustice. I emphasize criminal injustice against the Holy Land Foundation charity, this glorious organization that did extraordinary work, charity, helping needy people in occupied Palestine and various other countries, right here in the United States. On December 4th, 2001, the Treasury Department, I'll call them HLF, declared HLF a terrorist organization. Froze its assets, falsely claimed they were being used to funnel millions of dollars to Hamas, that's on the State Department's list as a terrorist organization, even though it is not. It's a legitimate, democratically elected government. Regular listeners to this program know that. HLF has been put through hell ever since. And in the past few weeks, the five principals of the organization, after going through two trials, one was declared a mistrial, and then a second one, and they were convicted. And two of the principals got 65 years. Three others got 20 years or 15 years. For doing what? For providing charity. Let me quote them before I introduce my guests. In response to what was done to them, they said, "We gave books, not bombs, bread, not bullets, smiles, not scars, toys, not tanks, peace, not terror, liberty, not poverty, hope, not despair, love, not hate, life, not death." 65 years in federal prison for that. I have two guests today. Nancy Hollander is a criminal defense attorney and executive director of the New Mexico Civil Liberties Union. And she has many other credentials besides that. She represents Shukri Abubakar. He's president and CEO of the Holy Land Foundation charity. I hear that music going. Until it was falsely shut down and went through all I just told you. I also have Shukri's daughter, Zahra, on the program. We want to talk about what happened to Zahra's father. He got 65 years. And Nancy's work representing him. Zahra, Nancy, bear with me. I took the entire first segment. Didn't mean to do that, but it just happened. Let's take a break. We have a...
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour, talking about political prisoners, and specifically Shukri Abubakar, who was president and CEO of the Holy Foundation charity. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Oh, it's wonderful having you. Have we got Zara on the line as well? Zara?
Yeah.
Oh,
can you hear me?
Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm really delighted to have you on. This is such an important issue to me. It shocks me that a country calling itself a democracy would dare to do something like this to anybody for any reason. People like your father should be held up and given awards and praised for what they did, and to target them so unfairly. This is a gross injustice, and it's why I stay on this all the time. Nancy, maybe you can go through the timeline and explain to listeners exactly what happened. You've been involved, so you know the details much better than I do.
Yes, I can, and to try to keep it relatively simple, in December of 2001, the Holy Land Office assets were all frozen, and it was designated by the President and by the Department of the Treasury as a foreign terrorist organization. We began its representation then, litigated that, and lost, although we were never allowed to see the evidence against Holy Land, and we were not allowed to present our evidence against Holy Land. Then in 2004, the gentlemen were all indicted and charged with providing material support to Hamas. But it is very significant that the government's allegations were never that they provided any bombs, guns, or did anything violent. The allegation was that they provided charity to organizations in Palestine that the United States government says were associated with or controlled by Hamas. That's the allegation. That's what they were convicted of, providing charity.
That really is shocking. I hope my listeners, Nancy, are shocked to hear something like that. And I want to stress again, and my regular listeners understand this. I don't have to explain it for those that are new and don't know the real facts, what's going on in occupied Palestine. Hamas is not a terrorist organization, but they were labeled one, I believe, around 1995, right on the State Department's list. Other organizations are so listed as well that are not terrorist organizations. In other words, the ones that Israel opposes for whatever reason that has nothing to do with terrorism, they go right on this list.
Well, the important point for us is that the organizations that we gave money to were not associated with Hamas. These were all charity organizations that had been licensed either by the Palestinian Authority at a time when it was not controlled by Hamas, or by the country of Jordan, or by Israel itself. And so it's our view that our clients never provided any support, any of their charity, through any organizations that were associated with Hamas. Whether Hamas is a terrorist organization or not is simply not the issue for us. The issue for us is that we did not provide any resources to Hamas. We provided charity for orphans and families in need without any respect to what their politics were.
Oh, I do understand that, Nancy, and I do recall, I believe I said that in my article written about 7 months ago. That is crucially important, because if they knew that they might do something that would violate the law, they absolutely would refrain from doing it, and they did. And to provide charity to needy people who happen to live in Gaza or the West Bank, who have no connection whatsoever to the government, they're simply needy people.
Well, that's true, and there are two other points that are significant. One is that throughout its lifetime, Holy Land tried to find out from the government of the United States if there were organizations that it should avoid, and it could never get an answer, even though it went to the State Department, the FBI, the Israeli embassy. No one would assist it in making sure that its money went not to any organization that was on any list. And secondly, And I think very significantly, the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, provided funds to the same organizations at the same time Holy Land did, and for several years afterwards, all the way up till the time that government changed in 2006. And it's just inconceivable to me that Holy Land individuals should be going to jail, and yet at the same time, and even after the U.S. government had indicted them and charged them with these specific transactions to specific charities, USAID continued to provide funds to the same charities.
That really is shocking. I did not know that, and I know I didn't say it in my article. That really is shocking. The trial as well, Nancy, was really a travesty of a trial, and I think that the things that went on in the courtroom are very similar to what have taken place in other trials like this. Explain the fact that there was evidence they wouldn't let you see. They used an anonymous testimony, something that in a real trial it would be inconceivable that something like this would happen. And the defendants, Shukri and the other defendants, weren't even allowed to go back and review what apparently had been wiretapped and kept. They couldn't even review the statements that they purportedly made to see exactly what this is, so you could respond to it. Explain all of that.
Well, that's all true. This is the first time in an American courtroom that I'm aware of where an anonymous expert was allowed to testify, and we, of course, therefore, were not allowed to know anything about him. Generally, it's required that a defendant be allowed to see his own statements, any statements he's made, and, of course, they weren't allowed to see them because they were classified. There were 10 years of wiretapped statements in Arabic. We couldn't possibly go through them without the assistance of our clients, and we didn't have their assistance. But both of those are very significant.
I think it's also significant that Justice Department, FBI, whatever, spent many, many years following the activities of Holy Land.
That's true. They knew exactly where all this money was going because they had the wiretaps. They were able to see the faxes, see the money transfers. They knew where all this money was going for years. And it's always been my position that if the United States government really believed this money was going to support terrorism, then the United States government had an obligation to stop it and didn't, because it wasn't.
And they certainly wouldn't have waited many years and let funds go year after year after year. I mean, if something destructive is going on and you know about it, you absolutely would take steps to stop it. So they simply wanted to acquire all of this material on wiretap and then put together whatever they did. And who knows how they put together what they said they had to make a jury believe that something that might not have been the case in fact was as they presented it. In other words, distort the whole picture. And at the same time, they scare jurors. They scare jurists to think that decent, honorable people are bad guys. They literally can intimidate a jury to convict. And if they don't get it the first time, then they go back and they try again.
Well, that's true. It's always easier for the government to get a conviction the second time. We've seen that in many, many cases.
And in some cases, it takes three times.
That's true. In some cases, it does take three times, like the case in Miami.
Oh, the case in Miami, the crazy idea that they would blow up the Sears Tower in Chicago where I live.
Right.
I mean, what a preposterous charge to make against anybody. My goodness. But they did it, and the third time around, they scared a jury into convicting. So, again, innocent people. I wrote about them as well. I only know about the cases that I've written about, Nancy. And in all of the, maybe about ten cases. I can't cover them all. Maybe about 10 cases. In all those 10 cases, there is absolutely no doubt whatever that those charged and convicted were absolutely innocent people. Absolutely innocent people. All men, one woman. Afia Siddiqui. I don't know if you're at all familiar with her.
Mm-hmm.
In her case, they shipped her off to Bagram Air Base to be tortured.
Well, you know, they've had a very high success rate, and they have actually convicted people who were guilty, and we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that all the cases involve innocent people, because they don't. El-Mari admitted to being a sleeper agent, and ironically, he's going to get, or did get, a maximum of 15 years that the government agreed to, even though he admitted that he had been a sleeper agent sent by Al-Qaeda. And the thought that the government agreed to 15 years for him and thought that was enough, and yet our clients received 65 years for providing charity is quite remarkable, to say the least.
It's a fact, and we'll be breaking very shortly for another short commercial. It is a fact that the original 600-odd people brought to Guantanamo were absolutely innocent. Most of them were randomly picked up because bounties were offered for Taliban and for Al-Qaeda. So if you didn't like your next-door neighbor, you could turn them in and call them Al-Qaeda and get a bounty. The vast majority were absolutely innocent people.
Yeah, about 85% were picked up by bounty.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Nancy Hollander, defense attorney for Shukri Abubakar, and also Shukri's daughter, Zara. Zara, welcome. Forgive me, I haven't given you any ear time so far. I want to do it right now.
Thank you, Stephen. I really appreciate what you've been through.
Explain what you've been through in your perspective on this. It's happened to your father. Oh, I say that knowing, my goodness, if it happened to my father or a loved one, I would be speechless to talk about it. But please do, from your point of view.
Well, I mean, at first, there's really not enough words to express how we're feeling and what we're going through. Kind of like what Nancy said, ever since pretty much 2001 till now, we've been basically going through a lot as a family. Everything has been left in the air. However, now that we know what has happened, I guess I could tell you that at first we were extremely shocked, since the first child ended up in a mistrial. And then in November 24th, they were found guilty. We're four girls, with the youngest being eight. So I think it has taken an extremely large toll on the younger siblings. But everyone is extremely strong and faithful, and we have hope. I mean, our dad has always taught us to never give up and to always have faith. And I think that's basically what's keeping us moving and going. My father is an extremely strong man, and I can say that I'm proud and I'm honored. I mean, he is a political prisoner, and this isn't the first time this happens in our history. I guess it's just our turn. We're the minorities now that have to go through this. I grew up seeing my dad do his work. I grew up in the Holy Land Foundation. He just devoted all his life to helping the needy, and for the result of feeding the needy and devoting his life to that, he gets 65 years. I mean, that's just extremely heartbreaking. But I do have faith in the system, and I know that eventually the truth will prevail, and, you know, justice will be found. I mean, it's just going to take a matter of time, but, you know.
Oh, you simply have to keep pursuing this. It's the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing. I absolutely want to help. I'm appalled that this type of injustice can happen in a country like this,
right,
or happen in any country. So people need to speak out. I can do it in my writing. I can do it on this radio program, and I want to keep doing it. And I honestly feel that an injustice to anybody is an injustice to everyone. We simply can't tolerate this. I must say that there's some evidence that some appeals courts or enough justices sitting on them may be getting a little fed up with this. It was a case involving a Yemeni sheikh that I wrote about and a man working with him, that they also doing charitable work, and they also got appalling sentences, and they were overturned by an appeals court. And the decision that came down had very angry overtones in it, that this was a terrible injury, really chastising the district court judge for his role in this and the sentence imposed and so on, and just threw the whole case back. And I forget the details now. It's been a while since I've written on that. But I would say there could be a very good chance that this could be overturned on appeal. Nancy, are you handling the appeal yourself?
All of the lawyers involved in the case at trial will remain on through the appeal, so we'll all be working on it.
So you'll be working on it. Oh, I wish you well as this thing moves along. We can have another program on this. You know much better than I do that this can take time. You can have the proceeding, and then it can then a lot of months can go by before a decision comes down. Is that because they're so backed up?
Well, we just received the transcript last week, so we don't even have a schedule yet, because the first thing that has to happen is for the transcript to be produced, and then we'll receive fairly soon. We'll receive a briefing schedule from the court, and then the court will set oral argument, and then we wait for an opinion. So it's not because they're backed up; it's just because the process is long. It takes a year or two generally from the time of sentencing until the time you get an opinion.
Well, I know I've had Lynn Stewart on this program twice, and in her case, I had a chance to meet her. She came to Chicago when I met her about a year ago, and she was a trial attorney representing a Muslim client, now a world figure because of what was done to her. I think she was well known in her own circles before that, but after her own case, she became a world figure. And she was convicted for representing a client that the U.S. government absolutely wanted to put away for a long time, who before that client had got into trouble, actually worked with the U.S. and then we turned on our own asset and wanted to convict him and put him away for life, the blind sheikh.
Yeah.
Well, you probably remember the case. Lynn got 16 months. The judge in her case, the district judge, did not hand down the sentence that the Justice Department wanted. And he was a very angry judge at the Justice Department. So now it's on appeal. Lynn has been waiting a good number of months for an appeals decision. I think she'd probably have a very good chance on the whole thing being thrown out. We need to take another break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. On with Nancy Hollander, criminal defense attorney representing Shukri Abubakar and Shukri's daughter, Zahra. Zahra, some more comments from you. The appeals process is next. Your father and the other principals are all involved in this. And again, I stress, such glorious human beings. If you all lived in Chicago where I am, it would be an honor for me to have you as my friends.
Thank you.
I have some wonderful Muslim friends. One is a regular on my program, Palestinian, who was born in Gaza. We've gotten to know each other very well. But in most cases, I don't meet these people because we live in different cities and often in different countries. Mm-hmm. It's the one thing that I lament about all the time. I've met a few people that I've had on the program, but just a handful. But again, it's a big world, and We all live in one place, and in my case, I don't get around too much. But Zara, some more thoughts from you about what you've been through, and your mother, and three sisters.
Mm-hmm. I think my mother's pretty much holding us all together. She has to be the backbone of the family right now. You know, it's her husband, and then at the same time, she has responsibility of taking care of her daughters. It's like I said before, I mean, it's an extremely difficult time, but, you know, at least we have the fact that we're extremely proud of him and we have nothing to be ashamed of. We do get to go see him once or twice a week for about an hour and a half to 2 hours to visit him. And it's like you're extremely excited to go see him, and at the same time, it's like you have to say goodbye. And it's like, you know, things that you take for granted in life that you get to see him now only for 2 hours or 2 to 3 hours a week versus 24 hours, you know, a day or something of that sort. I mean, you need to don't take anything for granted in life. My father was everything to us. We had an extremely, extremely strong relationship with him, which makes things even harder for us. But like I said before, I mean, if it wasn't for my dad's upbringing and the way he raised us, then I don't think we would be able to go through this the way we're going through it. Like I said, we're extremely proud of him, and there's nothing to be ashamed of. And eventually, like, the truth will prevail. It's just a matter of time, and you know, we are a strong family. And even the other families, we all have hope, and we just keep our faith in God. Because in the end, I mean, I know our lawyers, Nancy, and all of them are doing their job, and they're doing the best that they can. And we appreciate everything they're doing. And we even appreciate you, Stephen, for having us on air and letting us speak out and spread the word. I mean, I really do appreciate that.
Well, let me say very emphatically that this program is available to you anytime. If there's something new and important to discuss, anytime, I welcome you on this program. And the same goes for others in the same situation. Where is your father being held right now?
He's in the Siegelville Federal Prison, which is about like half an hour away from us. So
and you're in Texas.
Yeah, we're in Texas. Yeah.
I know they can move prisoners as they choose to. They can ship them anywhere.
Yeah.
So sometimes for whatever reason they decide to send them far away from their families, which is a terrible thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But he's there now. Is there any word that he maybe moved someplace else?
I think that he's. Go ahead.
I can answer that. Steve, the Bureau of Prisons requirement is that they try to designate a prison as close as possible to the prisoner's home that meets the qualifications, and of course that sometimes means that they're very far away, as you say. The judge did request that the Bureau of Prisons keep all of them in Siegelville until the appeal is complete. So that they would be accessible and we would be able to find them easily, since we have to go to Dallas to do some of the work on the appeal. Some of the work on the appeal involves classified evidence, and we have to go to Dallas to do it anyway. So the judge ordered that. And in Shukri's case, he can't really order it. He recommended it, and we believe that the Bureau of Prisons will abide by that recommendation. He also recommended that in Shukri's case, because one of his daughters is disabled, that he be designated to a prison as close as possible to home. Again, the Bureau of Prisons does not have to abide by that, but they do try to do what the judge recommends. But we anticipate that until at least we have finished all of the briefing on the appeal, that they will stay in Dallas.
You're familiar.
Or in Siegelville, which is right near Dallas.
You're familiar with the two prisons that are called Communications Management Units?
Yes, I am.
Terre Haute, Indiana, and Marion, Illinois?
Yes.
And, of course, these violate Bureau of Prisons regulations, also a Supreme Court decision, by segregating Muslims from other members of the prison population. And they get around that by putting in one or two non-Muslims to claim that they're not breaking the rules. But it's basically to segregate Muslims, and they give them fewer privileges, less time with family, things like that. both of those locations would be far away from Texas, but at least for the time being, it looks like that's not an issue.
For the time being, that's not an issue, and we're grateful for that. It makes it much easier for the families, of course, to see them, and it also makes it much less expensive for the government, who's paying for us to represent them, so that when we go to Dallas to work on the appeal, we can also see the clients at the same time.
Are you getting access to classified information, though?
We have always had access to classified information. The lawyers have, who have security clearances. We actually have a secure room in Dallas where we can look at that information. It's that our clients can't see it.
But now during trial, weren't you denied access to a lot of information?
We were not denied access to the classified information. There's some information that we have been denied access to, but particularly involving the witness, the expert witness. That's because that information is classified in the state of Israel, and in order for him to come to the U.S. had to abide by those regulations. Now, we believe that that violated our client's rights, but we did have access to other classified information.
I think in other cases there was information declared classified and not available to defense attorneys.
Well, that does happen with some information. The government basically gets to decide, even if you have a security clearance, whether you have what's called a need to know the information and whether the information, by providing it to counsel, would violate or would interfere with U.S. national security. So there's certainly information that we did not have. But there's also information that we did have that we couldn't share with our clients, which raises other problems.
All this wiretap stuff over years, this you had no access to?
Well, we had access to it, but it was in Arabic. And,
it was in Arabic.
There was primarily in Arabic, and there was no way we could really get through all of it without assistance of our clients.
And Shukri and the others were denied access to it?
Correct. Ultimately, some of it was declassified. Some summaries were declassified.
Maybe you can't discuss this over the air, but I have a feeling that a lot of stuff they classify really never should qualify to be called classified in the first place. They simply do it.
Well, that's a whole additional issue of what is and isn't classified. The government is supposed to classify information based on national security concerns. And the executive order signed by the president specifically says that something cannot be classified merely to avoid embarrassment to the government. Whether it does or doesn't is sometimes a very subjective decision, but whether things get overclassified or not is an entirely different discussion.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we have a way of targeting individuals, including heads of state, Nancy, as threats to our national security. What really is involved is not that that person is a threat to our security. It may be a threat in the sense that that person wants to govern in a different way than we want that person to govern. So we do things like we just did to the president, the democratically elected president of Honduras. We manufactured a coup. There's a question that was made in Washington, and we ousted a democratic leader, and then we accuse him of all kinds of false things. So we can do it to charitable people like Shukri and the others from Holy Land, and we could do it to heads of state. We're an equal opportunity persecutor, Nancy. I guess that may be one way of saying it.
Well, the president stated in his speech in Egypt that the United States was responsible for a change of government in Iran many years ago, first time that I've ever heard a national leader admit that.
Well, it took 55 years to get an admission.
That's right.
1953, yes, Mohammad Mossadegh.
Right.
And it took two attempts to get rid of him, a beloved man in Iran at the time, an absolutely beloved, the most popular man in the country. And I've written about him too, and of course we brought, well, that's a separate story, But we've been, well, ever since 1979, we've been targeting Iran for regime change. Make
right.
no mistake, all of the ruckus over the Iranian election has got nothing whatsoever to do with election fraud. That's a ruse. What's at stake is trying to foment what we call a color revolution, or what's popularly called a color revolution, to get rid of a regime that simply will not surrender its sovereignty to us. That's the issue. Doesn't matter whether mullahs rule the country, or tyrants rule the country, or Democrats rule the country. Those are non-issues. The issue is a nation wanting to be independent versus a nation willing to sacrifice its sovereignty to do it our way.
Well, one of the other issues that you've raised about classified evidence has to do with the CIA secret sites and the fact that the evidence of what happened there is all classified, and there's a real question about what the purpose of that is. If it's to protect sources and methods, which is legitimate reason to classify evidence, if we're not going to use those methods again in the future, why are they being protected?
Oh, indeed. And I think another key point, too, is this country, at least since the World War II era, has been the most powerful military force in the world. And since World War II ended, this country has not had an enemy anywhere, and that includes the Soviet Union. The Cold War was invented. Soviet Union had no designs to attack us. We have no enemies, but yet we invent them for political reasons. So we invented Muslims as the enemy of choice after 9/11 to give us a reason to attack two Muslim countries. The one that we attacked second was the one that we wanted to attack first, Iraq. But we couldn't blame Saddam for attacking on 9/11. So we claimed that the Taliban did it, even though they'd had nothing to do with it either.
Mm-hmm.
So first we went after Afghanistan, and then we went after Iraq. But if you're going after Muslim countries, then you need to call Muslims bad guys. How else could you do it? So we demonized Muslims. Muslims have always been not treated too well in this country. And I can remember movies as a boy in the 1940s. That just didn't portray Muslims in a very friendly way. But as a young boy, 10, 12, 13 years old, you know, what do I know? It's just, cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians, whatever the films were about Muslims. But it's always been that way. And there's a book about it called Real Bad Arabs, R-E-E-L, meaning a movie reel, Real Bad Arabs. Forget the man who wrote it. So now, but then it went into high gear after 9/11. So all of these Muslim people, again, mostly men, have been falsely targeted and persecuted and trumped up charges against them, and innocent people charged and convicted and sentenced to prison terms. It truly is an outrageous thing. Unless we talk about this and keep talking about it, there's nothing about this in the news. When something, Nancy and Zara, when something like Holy Land comes along, the dominant media, the New York Times, the TV networks, they simply tell the government side of the story. They don't tell the other side. And part of the story is to convince the public that your government is watching out for your security. And we're doing our job, and we're finding these bad guys, and we're arresting them, and we're taking them out of circulation, and we're putting them in prison so they can't harm you. And what do ordinary people know? So-and-so was arrested, and these are the charges, and they never hear the other side. I mean, is it true? Is it false? They only hear one side, so they hear bad guys, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that, or they may do this, like blowing up the Sears Tower in Chicago. And this goes on. So I feel like a voice in the wilderness.
I know.
With a program like this. I don't have the audience that the New York Times has.
Right.
If I did, we could stop this. We could stop it real fast. Of course, they'd probably put me away.
Well, you'd run that risk, wouldn't you?
Well, I have been told flat out that not only am I being watched, but watch my back. Watch my back. Well, you know, I don't reach millions. If I did, I'd probably have to do this underground from a secret location and keep changing the location. But it's important to do, and this is, I'm almost 75. This is how I've chosen to spend my retirement, and I don't care what they're going to do. I'm going to keep doing this, and I'll stop if they come and they yank me away one night and they charge me with supporting terrorism. And then, Nancy, I'll have to contact you to come defend me.
Well, I'll be glad to.
Oh, my goodness. What more can you fill in on this case, things that listeners need to know about?
Well, I just think it's important for people to understand that there's a lot about what happened in that trial that we believe was unfair. We believe we have a good case on appeal. Our clients are strong, and it's tragic that they're in jail. But as Zaira said, they and their families are strong, and they'll remain so. And we will do everything that we can going forward on this case. And I just hope that people understand that the significance of what I've said, that they were only convicted of providing charity. It is against the law to provide charity to Hamas, but we don't believe they did that. But it was charity in the end.
Indeed. Let's take another break, then we'll come back for a final segment. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Back to the News Hour, on with Nancy Hollander, representing Shukri Abubakar and Shukri's daughter, Zaira. One quick comment, and Zaira, I'd like to give the last few moments to you with some final thoughts. I've had a good many wonderful lawyers on this program, Lynn Stewart, Brian Concannon, working for human rights for the people of Haiti, Michael Ratner, Center for Constitutional Rights, Marjorie Cohn, she was on last week, president of the National Lawyers Guild, other extraordinary people doing extraordinary work, and we need an army of them because there's so much injustice that needs to be addressed. And you, Nancy, my hat's off to you. It's so important what you're doing and others who are doing exactly the same thing. Zaira, let me let you finish up the program. We have 2 or 3 minutes left. Your final thoughts.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. Like you mentioned, I mean, we're extremely grateful for the lawyers that we have. I mean, they're putting all their effort into fighting for justice, which is a wonderful thing because, like you said, there's not a lot of people out there, and the ones that are actually putting their effort, I mean, we do have to be extremely thankful for that. Also, I think when you were talking earlier about just the fact that people really need to know what's going on, and I think many don't know what's going on. Like you said, they do hear only one side of the story, and you really can't blame people because this is what they see on TV, this is what they hear on the radio stations. I mean, so if people were informed and they knew what was going on, I'm sure they would be sympathetic and they would maybe, I guess, want to be part of the cause. But maybe that's where we come along, that we do need to spread the word, and people like you, Stephen, who are helping to do so, which is extremely something that we're extremely grateful for.
Zaira, again, I repeat, this program is available to you anytime whatsoever. Nancy, to you as well.
Thank you.
Or family members of the other four men,
yeah.
Especially with any new developments. It's important to let people know about this as this thing moves along. Zaira, I think you have my email address now.
Yes, I
sent you an email. Please save it.
I will, definitely.
And get in touch with me anytime whatsoever. I am available anytime for what you may need me for. I am absolutely, totally committed to this and so many other issues. I wish there were three or four of me. But I do all I can on so much that concerns me so much. This is my time of life to want to do something like this. My time is my own. I can do anything I want. Golf and tennis don't interest me. This interests me because it's so important.
We really appreciate that.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. Let me give you an idea of what will be coming up. Obviously, we'll be back on this issue again on future programs, probably with other people as well. And in programs coming up during the week, we'll get back on the economic situation, or we'll talk about some of the other things that the Obama administration is doing. I wish I could say that Obama has made a very, very sharp turn from what the Bush administration has done, whether on political prisoners or anything else, but I don't see it so far. But hopefully justice will prevail in the end. I think I hear the music in the background, so they'll be cutting away shortly. Let me just thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Zara.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Is important, and we will continue to talk about this. My great thanks for both of you for coming on today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen, for having us. We really do appreciate it.
And please come back and join us again tomorrow. We'll be back and bringing more important information on more important topics that everybody needs to know about. Join us then.